Radio Free Palmer, 89.5 KVRF, presents Mushing Radio, hosted by Robert Forto. Mushing Radio is about dog-powered sports, living in the Great White North, and mushing. Visit our website at mushingradio.com. Here is your host, Robert Forto.
Hello and welcome, everybody. This is Robert Forto, live from KVRF in Palmer, Alaska, and you are listening to Mushing Radio. And on the line, we have our co-host for our Iditarod coverage, Alex Stein, calling in from California. Alex, how's it going?
It's going great, Robert. How are you?
I am fine. I'm glad to be away from the chaos of the Iditarod Circus at their ceremonial start and the restart yesterday, and sitting here in a nice warm studio here in Palmer, and we're going to rock and roll on this Iditarod coverage, huh?
Excellent. And I'm sure you have plenty of stories and of what you experienced in the last 2 days that I'm sure people will be anxious to hear.
You know, that's kind of interesting. I didn't get to see a whole lot of stuff. I was busy helping out my friend Hugh Neff, and pretty much I saw his dog truck and his way up to the start. And other than that, I didn't get a lot of chance to mingle with the other folks.
Ah, okay. Well, there's always next year.
There's always next year. You know, with that, I hope the next time I'm down there at the ceremonial start, I'll be on the sled myself. So that's my plan anyway.
Exactly.
So what is... Alex.
Sorry, I just wanted to mention, I keep forgetting to mention this, and every time we finish a show, I think, oh, I should have mentioned that. Very briefly, the first Saturday in March in the state of Alaska is Susan Butcher Day, an honorary holiday named for Susan Butcher, four-time Iditarod champion, beloved female musher who sadly passed away from cancer a few years back. And so now the first Saturday of every March is the ceremonial start of the Iditarod. And now, thanks to the governor of Alaska, that is now going to be known as Susan Butcher Day.
Very cool. It's an honor to have a day named after you. Unfortunately, she did pass away several years ago from cancer. But, you know, her legacy and her legend lives in infamy up here in Alaska and on the Iditarod Trail.
Yeah, and she really was one of the people responsible for making the sport of mushing much more popular. She worked a lot with Joe Reddington Sr. She had a lot of dogs that came from the bloodlines of dogs that he raised and that he bred. And even now, people speak with reverence about dogs that are descended from the dogs that Susan Butcher raised as well. So you'll frequently hear someone talk about having a Susan Butcher dog in their kennel. And almost inevitably, when people say that, they sort of get this starry look in their eyes as if they know that this dog has a bit of the greatness that Susan Butcher brought to the race.
You know, that's interesting because I do have a Susan Butcher dog in my dog yard. His name is Denali. He's one of my go-to leaders I got from Hugh Neff this past October, and he is an exceptional lead dog. And, you know, he's, of course, I don't know how many generations back from the original Susan Butcher lines, but he is one great sled dog.
Yeah. Kind of amazing for people who don't know much about breeding dogs that some of the top mushers and some of the people who develop really strong kennels are able to just breed some absolutely amazing canine athletes. So Susan Butcher certainly falls in that category.
So with that, let's start talking about the race. We're about 27 hours into it now, and there's already some moving and shaking in terms of the leaderboard. We spend a lot of time talking about Hugh just because he's a good friend of mine, but of course we're not biased, but I guess we don't have to be here on public radio. We can pretty much root for whoever we want. But anyway, Hugh is currently in first in Rainy Pass. He got in there at 9:05 this morning and left at 2:58, so he's on his way to the next checkpoint, and then following him are Ray Reddington, Aaron Burmeister, and of course fan favorite Lance Mackey. Do you have any interesting stories or tidbits about your searches today in your coverage for the first day of the race, Alex?
Well, you know, it's very, very interesting. There, Hugh Neff, I guess for the past few Iditarods, has been known as kind of a jackrabbit musher. He's the kind of musher who will get out in front and usually lead or be right up by the leaders for a significant portion of the race. In the past few Iditarods, he's not been able to sustain that, but we were having a discussion on Twitter this afternoon about whether with the momentum that he gets from his Yukon Quest victory, which is just a couple weeks ago, if that might be enough to sort of get his dogs to the point where they can really dominate all the way through.
Right, exactly. And he'll be the first to tell you that he has been known to peak and then occasionally even crash with that. And he's been working on that for years and figuring out a way to do that. And, you know, it's tough. When you're behind the dog sled and your dogs are raring to go, it's tough to slow them down, so to speak, to calm them down, I guess, is a better word. Because a lot of people don't understand this, Alex, but you're only going an average of 6 miles an hour. That's not very fast in terms of dog sledding, unlike sprint racing, where you're going up to 20 miles an hour. These guys are just kind of trudging along at a very even speed between 6 and 10 miles an hour. So a lot of people think, wow, these guys are just burning down the trail, but they're really not.
Yeah, and the other thing to keep in mind is it's a very, very long trail. We are relatively early in this race. We're, I believe the leaders are about 150 miles in, more or less. So there's a lot of trail to go through. That having been said, this afternoon most of the teams went through the Happy River Steps, which, as we discussed on Friday, those were originally not going to be part of this race. That's the very steep switchbacks where there have been some spectacular crashes throughout the years. And then on Friday afternoon, the race marshal decided, after evaluating the alternate route, that the alternate route was not an improvement and changed back to going down the steps. The first teams that went down the steps reported that it was actually very good. There's been a ton of snow in that part of Alaska this year, so it seems like, from the reports that we've heard, that it was much easier going this year than it has been in the past.
Right, right. And as you said, a lot of course, the front runners have already been down, and several of the other group, I guess, of the next tier of the racers in this year's race are getting ready to head down those steps right now. Do you see in your coverage, I think you have the insider, do you not, Alex?
Yeah.
Have you seen any video of the steps, anything that you want to report on that from your viewing today?
I actually haven't seen video of the steps yet. I'm sure there is some video of the steps. And I should just preface or append to what I said. When I say it's relatively easy, that's, of course, very, very simple for me to state. I'm here drinking tea out of an Alaska mug. I'm very nice and warm. I'm not on a sled. I'm not going downhill at 20 miles per hour. Easy is a relative term. I think easy compared to past years when it's been absolutely treacherous. So having more snow would help slow the sleds down and make it a little bit more easy going on those very, very steep switchbacks.
Right, that's exactly right. And I haven't been down that way either, so I can't comment on the difficulty either. But any rookie will tell you that's one of the first things that they think about and train for is that section of trail there at the Happy River Steps. So that's going to be interesting to see how some of the less experienced mushers who are down in the standings right now, how they figure out how to get through that part and on into the gorge where it is just as difficult. This section of the trail, a lot of people will say, if they can make it to Nikolai with the sled that they have and the dogs that they have right now, it's a relatively different race after they reach Nikolai. Have you heard anything about that before?
Yeah, absolutely. And I believe that there are a lot of mushers who will ship out a second sled. So they'll ship a second sled either to Nikolai or to McGrath. So they'll have a sled that is really built for the very rough conditions early in the course, and then when they get either to Nicolai or to McGrath, they will switch to another sled that is much better suited towards your long, relatively flat runs that you have later in the race.
So we've talked about the front runners of the race, and just to talk about that one more time in terms of standings at this point, which is about 6:40 Alaska time. In first place, we have Hugh Neff. Second is Ray Reddington Jr. Aaron Burmeister has moved up from 44th place all the way into third. Lance Mackey in fourth place. Ali Zirkel in fifth. John Baker sixth. Kelly Griffin in seventh. Rick Swenson moved from 60th to eighth position, so he's doing relatively well. Nicholas Pettit in ninth position, Paul Gephardt in 10th. So I know we talked early on in talking about our coverage, Alex, about covering some backstories, some stories about the middle of the packer guys that don't get all of the coverage in the Alaska Anchorage Daily News or the Iditarod Insider or places like that. I'm sure you have a plethora of stories about some of these guys. Who do you want to talk about tonight? Let's talk about it in a daily showcase, if you will, on our Iditarod coverage.
Sure. I actually am very interested in a musher named Pat Moon. And Pat Moon is someone who is, I believe he suffers from ulcerative colitis, which can be a very debilitating disease. And part of the reason why he's running the race is to show that someone, to bring awareness to that disease and to show that someone with that disease can really be at the highest levels. He's also interesting because, and I think you can speak to this as well, he left with only 12 dogs from Willow. And Iditarod rules say that you can leave with between 12 and 16 dogs. And he left with a minimum of 12 dogs. Now, usually, almost always, mushers will start with 16 dogs. So if there's also a saying that you can only go as fast as your slowest dog. So if you have dogs that aren't really up to going as fast as the others, and perhaps if you have a small kennel, you would want to leave with fewer dogs. But it seems unusual to me that a musher would leave with as few as 12.
That's a great point, Alex. And the first thing I would like to say about that is Pat, he's a very small guy. I don't know the weight exactly, but he is probably one of the smallest males in the field. So that weight differential between the musher and, of course, the number of pounds that team has to carry is significant. If you think about the size of him and somebody like Jake Berkowitz, he's probably the biggest guy in the field of mushers. He's probably at least 240, I would guess, 240 pounds. So he's a big guy. But with that, you know, there's not a big difference in terms of pulling power between, you know, 180 and 240 pounds for a dog team. They don't understand that slight variation in weight. So I don't think that plays a whole lot into it. But the problem with a 12-dog team is you don't have the ability to drop that many if problems arise on the trail. You have to finish the race with 8, I believe, is the official rule. So he can figuratively only drop 4 dogs in the next 1,000 miles. So that comes into play in terms of his strategy a little bit, but it's definitely doable to finish with 12 dogs. All of the mid-distance races up here in Alaska are 12-dog maximum races. When you're thinking about the Connect 200 or the Copper Basin or the Don Bowers or any Tustamina 200, any of those races are all 12-dog limits. So it's definitely possible for a small team to pull that distance at that, at that severity, I guess, if you say, on conditions like this.
Yeah. But as you said, it does make it more difficult because he's going to have to try to get more out of these dogs, and it's a much harder decision to drop a dog when you know that you don't have very much leeway.
You know, if we could concentrate on that for just a second, Alex, in terms of drop dogs, you often hear fans saying, oh, man, you know, Max was dropped, and that's the fan favorite, you know, maybe a lead dog or a dog that one of the mushers always talks about on social media and in blogs. And people have to understand that dogs are dropped for different reasons. Dogs are on the trail for different reasons. Sometimes you may bring Max on the trail just to get you over those Happy River steps or to pull you in the you know, the difficult part of the race. Therefore, he is not needed. He's done his job, so he can be dropped, and you know, he might not be ready for the next stage of the race. So it's not necessarily a bad thing that a dog is dropped at one particular point or another.
Exactly. And dogs are, you know, as you said, dogs are dropped for a lot of different reasons. It could be that the dog has strained a muscle, or it could be that the dog just doesn't quite look right or isn't quite acting right, or sometimes there are dogs that are become a little bit cantankerous with the other dogs and aren't really getting along with them. And you want to make sure that you have a dog team that can really work at their maximum efficiency.
That's exactly right, and I've always been taught, and I tell others, when in doubt, drop that dog, because it's just going to prohibit your team in moving forward in the best direction. It's not a bad thing to drop dogs. They're very well taken care of, and this is an interesting side story that a lot of folks don't know about. If a musher does not have handler support like he needs to have, the drop dogs are flown to Anchorage and then sent over to the women's prison here in Eagle River, which is a kind of a suburb of Anchorage, and they're cared for there at the correctional facility by the women. Do you have anything to share on that in your dealings with these folks in the Iditarod?
Yeah, it's actually kind of an amazing thing that happens. The dogs are flown back to Anchorage from various points on the trail, and then they are kept in back of the Millennium Hotel, which is the official hotel of the Iditarod, and there are special volunteers who do dog care there. And as you said, then the local contact in Anchorage comes to pick them up. If someone can't come and pick them up, they're taken about 15 miles to this prison, and it's a minimum security women's prison, and there have been a lot of studies about how dealing with animals is a very helpful thing in terms of rehabilitation. This is only for the best behaved prisoners, and it's not something that everyone can do. It's a reward for good behavior, and it's something that in the prison is a very I'm not sure what the right term is. It's a very prestigious thing to be allowed to help care for these dogs. And they are extremely, extremely well cared for there. And they will stay there until the musher can make arrangements for someone to come and pick them up.
You're listening to Mushing Radio, talking with myself, Robert Forto, and our co-host, Alex Stein, calling in from California. He is the writer and director of Mush the Movie. And Alex, before we go today, we have about 12 minutes left, but we got to make sure that we mention our giveaway. We've already given three away on our Facebook page, Dogworks Radio, but our giveaway during our Iditarod coverage is a copy of an advanced screening of your movie, Mush the Movie. Tell us a little bit about that contest we got going on.
It's actually very simple. All you have to do is go over to our page, the Dogworks Radio page on Facebook, and like it, which you should do anyway. And then we will randomly pick one of the likes per day, and they will get an advanced DVD copy of the movie.
And we've already, like I said, we've already given away three copies of the movie. So this is something that a lot of folks haven't seen. And I know the only people that are listening to this are Iditarod fanatics. So it's something that is very special. And we want to make sure that you guys get a chance to see this before Alex becomes the big time and he's standing on the red carpet somewhere.
Excellent. And when I'm standing on the red carpet, I'm going to do it in mukluks.
Very good. Very cool. So, Alex, again, we have about 10 minutes left. What is the next topic for day two of our Iditarod coverage here on Mushing Radio?
Well, you know, know, it's interesting that there are, especially early in the race, some of the things you see in the standings can be a little bit deceiving. For example, Aaron Burmeister, who is I think currently in second or third, made a huge jump. And part of the reason he made that jump is that he did not stop for a significant amount of time in Rainy Pass. So many of the mushers stopped for 6 or 7 hours there. Aaron was in and out in 7 minutes. And if you look at a lot of the mushers who have made big leaps, like Kelly Griffin and Rick Swenson, part of the reason they made such big leaps is that they didn't spend any significant time in Rainy Pass. It's a little bit hard to tell what that means. It could mean that they had rested on the trail before they got there, or it could mean that their team is going to be more tired when they get to the next checkpoint and will have to rest more at the next checkpoint than a team like Hugh Neff's team or Lance Mackey's team, which had a good solid 6 hours of rest.
That's exactly right. And we're going to talk a lot about run rest schedules and layovers and 24s and 8s as we get into our coverage later on in our coverage of the Iditarod. But a lot of people don't understand that you don't have to stop at every checkpoint and spend an extended period of time. You can literally come in, sign the book, and sign out in a matter of just a couple of minutes. So it's not necessary that you spend any amount of time at a particular checkpoint unless it's your required 8 or 24 hour. So we'll talk about that much longer as we're continuing on in the race, but that's a very important part of race strategy. Hugh and I were talking this weekend, and we talked a little bit about that, and I said, what's the plan? He said, I'm not going to spend a lot of time camping on the trail. I'm going to spend some time in checkpoints this year, just because the way the race is set up this year versus last year, where it's a much faster trail than this year. And he even told a couple of rookies that came up and talked to him. He said, don't spend a lot of time on the trail camping. Spend it in the checkpoints where you have some support. So I think that's very key in doing that. But when somebody does stop for an extended period of time, that does reflect in terms of their standings. And it's very difficult to follow the race and make predictions just by looking at numbers on the web. You can't do that. There's so many things going on back and forth that go into play here, and the typical armchair musher just can't figure that out by watching a list on a web page.
Right, and there, as you mentioned, there are several required layovers. There's an 8-hour layover at a Yukon River checkpoint. So any checkpoint at on the Yukon, you have to take an 8-hour layover. There's a 24-hour layover, which you can take anywhere on the trail. And then there's another 8-hour mandatory layover at White Mountain, which is about, I believe it's under 100 miles from the finish.
Right. That's exactly right. And they do that for a reason. They do that, number one, of course, so everybody can have the same amount of run rest, because literally you could, plug away at your desire throughout the race as long as you do those mandatories. But they also do it in terms of the support staff, which is a tremendous undertaking by Iditarod with all the checkers and the vets and the volunteers and all that goes into that. So it's very logistical, and that is one of the main reasons why they do have those particular checkpoints, like you said, White Mountain and one on the Yukon.
Right. And, the logistics of the race are an amazing undertaking. And in addition to all of the volunteers and the vets who are flown up and down the trail, whenever a musher drops a dog at a checkpoint, that dog has to then be flown back to Anchorage. There's a dedicated group of pilots in small planes who are called the Iditarod Air Force, and they take race officials and volunteers and drop dogs and supplies all up and down the trail. So almost every checkpoint you will see these amazing pilots in small planes flying in and out all the time.
That's exactly right. And, you know, one of the most controversial rules of the Iditarod is the back-of-the-pack rule. And I know you and I are going to talk a lot about this as we're moving into the race. And today we're just kind of giving a general synopsis of what's going on in day one. We don't have a lot of stories to report, so to speak, in terms of things going on the trail, such as scratches or crashes or problems. You know, last year it was just a plethora of interesting stories. On day one, things were happening. We just don't have that yet. So we're definitely going to talk a lot about that back of the pack rule. Do you care to share just what that is without going into any detail? We don't want to give it all away on day one.
Yeah, and I'm not exactly sure what the numbers are, but basically the rule is that there are certain times when you have to come into certain checkpoints in order to be deemed still competitive. And it's a certain number of hours past when the leader comes into that checkpoint. So you have to get to McGrath, I believe, within a day and a half of when the leader gets to McGrath, or perhaps 2 days. Now, there's some wiggle room in that the race marshal has discretion to enforce that rule or not enforce that rule. And sometimes if the race marshal feels that that a musher who is a little bit behind that time period is still making good progress and is still progressing, they will let that team continue. Other times they will either talk the musher into scratching or disqualify them. And part of the reason for that also is practical. Checkpoints have to be closed so that the staff can go and staff upcoming checkpoints. There's not enough staff to fly people into a checkpoint and have them stay there for 2 weeks. So the vets and the veterinary techs and a lot of the volunteers will be leapfrogging up and down the trail to make sure that each checkpoint is fully staffed when the mushers are coming through.
That's a great point. And again, we're going to cover this a lot as people start to maneuver into positions. And I think an important part of that is to talk a little bit about what happened last year. Last year when John Baker came in under a little over 9 days, the last musher, the Red Lantern winner, was well over 5 days behind him. So that's a big gap between the first musher and the last musher in last year's race. And I'm sure we'll see something very similar to that this year as well.
Yeah. And especially when you have a race that at the front is as fast as it was last year. And last year it was pretty amazing how fast it was. Actually, the past several years, the race at the front has just been lightning fast.
Exactly.
And so there's not as big a rush, I think, to disqualify people when the front runners are going so quickly.
Right. And I don't know if we're going to have a record-breaking pace like we had last year. It's much different in terms of weather and snow. And you never know what tomorrow is going to bring. Tomorrow we could have 40-degree weather and balmy, or we could have minus 60 and blizzard conditions out there on that trail. So you just don't know. You can't forecast, pun intended there, I guess, on what's going to happen tomorrow. So, Alex, we have about a minute and a half left. What do you want to cover tomorrow? Let's give a little primer to what's going to happen on day two of our Iditarod coverage.
Okay, well, the leads are going to be moving into Roan and Nicolai. It's about, from Rainy Pass to Roan is only 35 miles, but it's 75 miles to Nicolai, and then another 50 to McGrath, which is about a third of the way into the race. So that's going to be a very exciting thing to see when people are moving, when they're resting. And also, traditionally, this time is when some of the more interesting things start happening at the back of the pack. So I'm sure we'll be covering a lot of that as well.
Well, I'm looking forward to it, Alex. I appreciate it. And make sure, fans and listeners, that you go over to our Facebook page at Dogworks Radio. Alex and I are updating constantly blogs and stories and videos that we come across, and we're going to make sure that we're one of the cool sources to pay attention to, on at least on Facebook and Twitter. So make sure you go over there and check out our page. Alex, it's been a pleasure. We'll talk again tomorrow, okay?
Okay, thanks, Robert.
Thank you. So this is Robert Forto on behalf of my co-host Alex Stein. This is Mushing Radio on KVRF in Palmer, Alaska. So talk to you next time. Goodbye.